From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Letson. Today, we're going to revisit an hour we ran last fall because it'll soon be wildfire season in many parts of the country. And in some places, it's already started. So what does it take to make a city burn? In 1961, Bel Air found out. It sits in the hills above Los Angeles. And when a wildfire swept through neighborhoods there, it was an eye-opener. This is an L.A. Fire Department documentary made in the 60s.
Designed for disaster. Plants wither, trees and brush become crackling dry.
It shows scenes that shocked people at the time. Wooden roofs and yards filled with overgrown vegetation that fed flames as the fire swept through an exclusive neighborhood. Thousands fled their homes as fire crews struggled to contain the blaze.
The potential of 134 square miles of thick, dry chaparral and oak, all within the city boundaries of Los Angeles, classed by experts as the fastest burning ground cover in the Western Hemisphere. And nestled in that cover, one of the greatest concentrations of high-value homes in America. A
serious problem. Hundreds of homes were destroyed. In the 6,100-acre firestorm that still ranks among the 20 most damaging fires in California history, fire historian Stephen Pine calls this the beginning of a new era in fighting wildfires.
The Bel Air fire really was a real stunner. To have what was nominally a city burn like this, when in most of the industrial world, you had to have an earthquake or a war to be able to shatter the system sufficiently to burn large chunks of city.
During the 55 years since Bel Air burned, wildfires within city limits have become way more common. But the question is why, and just how widespread are they? That's what Eric Segarra wanted to find out. He's a data journalist at Reveal, and he spent about a year analyzing data at his desk and reporting in the field to figure out why more Americans are at risk of losing their homes and even their lives to wildfire. Eric brought in some of what he carries with him when he heads out to cover fires. So, Eric, what do you got?
So in this bag, we have some of the fire gear that we took with us on our road trip through Southern California and Northern Arizona. It's a big jumble of mess here. Okay, so we bring in our fire boots. We bring in the fire retardant pants and shirts, gloves, a helmet, and a fire shelter.
So what does a fire shelter do?
So the fire shelter is kind of the last resort for a firefighter in trouble in the wildfire situation. And the way it works is they yank it out, and they unfold this big, massive thing.
And they get under it?
Right. And so they get under it. I've heard it called things like a Jiffy Pop bag or a shake and bake.
It totally looks like a Jiffy Pop.
So once they deploy these things, they take it up, they put it on, they fall down into the ground, and they're covered by it, and they're not supposed to get out no matter what.
That's intense. Now, you've been reporting on fires for a long time, right?
Yeah, I started reporting fires in the early 2000s as an intern. And I went so far as to go ahead and get trained as a wildland firefighter, at least take the basic training levels.
You know, what are you seeing differently? Because now you're not just focused on one area, you're looking at the whole country.
Right. And this allows me then to go ahead and use my expertise as a data reporter to look at some of the data sets that are out there covering this sort of issue and analyze some of the trends that we're seeing. Basically, fires are getting larger throughout the United States, particularly in the West. But throughout the United States, we're seeing an increase in fire size.
Does development have anything to do with all of this?
It does, actually. The population growth is huge in these areas right now, and that's an issue.
So fires are now year-round. They're getting a lot bigger, and they're spreading beyond the West, happening all over the country. Because people are settling in these wild areas, we're actually seeing more damage to homes and more lives lost. That's what landed Eric back in Los Angeles County, where, nowadays, it's always fire season. Since the Bel Air fire, there have been more than 1,500 other fires in California's most populated county. He arrived in mid-July last year, just in time for what was known as the Sand Fire, named after nearby Sand Canyon.
This is a hot, fast fire in canyons where scattered neighborhoods dot the Angeles National Forest. Three of us from Reveal ride in a rented SUV along roads lined with chaparral. It's a bush that sweats flammable oil when it's warm. We stop where the road cuts through the hillside. On the other side, it's just a wall of smoke. We back into a parking space and leave the engine running in case we need to leave quickly. Nearby, a group of firefighters is planning the air attack.
So we're trying to keep it from jumping this ridge line.
Up on the south side, down low in the canyon.
That's Andrew Violante from the San Marcos Fire Department.
Well, the main head of the fire is running north, and we're trying to keep this slop over side of the fire from moving this way. And we have air support in the air painting this whole ridge line with retardant.
Soon, a heavy lift helicopter hovers in low, dropping loads of neon pink retardant from the sky. By accident, I get a mouthful.
Oh, the fire retardant, it tastes just like dish soap.
Even with the ground and air fight, I can still see fire lurking around the mountain. We've got flames on either side of the road, including up on the ridgeline. I can see the fire torching through some larger brush about 50 feet away. And I should feel the heat on my face from the hillside that's burning next to me. Woo-wee.
Just on the other side of that hill, a suburban neighborhood pushes into the wildland area.
There's flames to the... Well, just about every direction you look.
Firefighters are positioned on the hill around an evacuated cul-de-sac, ready to defend homes. There's something so post-apocalyptic about a suburban neighborhood on a sunny day with no people. Sprinklers are running on the rooftops in a feeble attempt to keep their homes safe.
To me, it's just wasting water.
Firefighters like Dave Schwab from Ventura County have parked their engines. They're scattered throughout the neighborhood, just waiting for the fire to hit. I see other firefighters perched on rooftops. They have a better view of the flames from there and can put out any embers that fly their way. Homeowners in this area have lived with fires like this. Many have cleared brush around their houses to create what firefighters call defensible space.
They've given us a fighting chance to help them, you know. So it's the properties where you don't see that it's just difficult for us, and then it makes it dangerous for us.
Dangerous and expensive. In California, it costs $1,700 an acre to put out fires where wildland meets homes. The Agriculture Department's Inspector General reports that's more than twice what it costs to fight fires in forests without people. Stephen Pine has written 20 books examining all this.
We know how to keep houses from burning. We've known it for a long time.
Problem is, more people than ever choose to live near nature. To find out just how many people that is, I analyzed a database from the University of Wisconsin. It has millions of records that help me pinpoint where houses mingle with wildland. I found that more than a third of the nearly 16 million homes built in the U.S. since 2000 are in places at risk of wildfires. The sand fire is only 10% contained when some of the 20,000 evacuees are allowed to return. Homeowner Sherilyn Gomez is one of them. I ask her, what does all this look like to people who have never seen a wildfire?
It twirls and it moves and it's unpredictable. You know, at times it was going three different directions at the same time and the winds would change and swirl and you're just hoping and praying it isn't going to get, you know, anybody. This is the third one I can remember that was actually real threatening.
And have you evacuated in the past?
Yes, three times. Why do we stay? It's a wonderful neighborhood. It's a wonderful community and we take our chances. And, you know, the odds are, I mean, we're still, after three fires, we're still here.
As we drive away past the blackened landscape, a column of smoke rises in the dirt-brown sky. It would take 12 days for firefighters to contain the sand fire. It killed a man, destroyed 18 homes, burned more than 40,000 acres, and stripped the hillsides of every living thing. Why do fires like this still happen? To learn more, I went to see Wally Covington, who heads the Ecological Restoration Institute at Northern Arizona University. He looks like a tall, outdoorsy grandfather with a twinkle in his eye. His research has changed the way Americans manage forests through techniques he calls treatment, cutting down trees to thin the forest, setting controlled burns, that kind of thing. Wally tells me that 100-acre fires used to be outliers, freak occurrences.
Then it got to be 1,000 acres, and people said, well, still, it's an unusual event. It's a really dry year, lightning hit in the wrong place and so on. But once it got into every year in and year out, millions of acres burning each year, then people said, whoa, something's bad here. Something's wrong.
The two of us stand in a swath of forest divided by a dirt path. On one side, large, centuries-old pines with orange-yellow bark dot an open landscape. This is the way, Wally says, forests should look. On the other side, younger, darker pines stand in what people call a dog hair patch, dense like the hair on the back of a dog. This is what many forests look like today. Wally studies the two sites in his outdoor laboratory, where he tries to restore the forest. To explain why, he carries a cross-section of stump from a tree that began growing in the late 1600s. The rings in this stump tell the story of forest policy over 500 years. In the middle of this stump, the tree was young. Its rings are wide, indicating healthy growth. Then, lightning struck it in 1757. From that time forward, you can see the stump is lined with scars from fires. There's 1773, 1785, 1803. So this forest is supposed to burn every 2 to 7 years under natural conditions. That's 1839, 1857. All told, 18 fires from 1757 to 1876. Then the fires stopped.
Shortly after 1876, cattle and livestock grazing began in earnest out here, and serious overgrazing.
Wally points out the tree's rings got thinner as it continued to grow. That's because it had to compete with more vegetation for the nutrients it needed to stay alive. This made it more vulnerable to insects, drought, and fire. Conditions like this affect millions of trees throughout the country.
This overgrazing was actually encouraged by early foresters as a way to keep fire out of the forest, because fire was seen as the enemy.
Now scientists say climate change will alter fire activity throughout the United States. Wet periods will be wetter, dry periods drier. Storms will bring less rain and snow. Instead, we'll see more lightning that sparks wildfires and wind that can drive flames with explosive force.
The story has still nationally been one where stupid Westerners are putting houses where there are fires. And that's true.
Stephen Pine knows this from experience. He spent 15 years as a wildland firefighter. He used what he knew to keep his vacation home safe from a fire 5 years ago.
But if the climate change modelers are correct, we're going to start seeing the fires go to where the houses are. And that's going to be increasingly be on the east. At that point, it becomes a national story.
There's a lot of information about wildfires in the West because there's more federal land there, and the federal government keeps track of all that data. We know less about wildfires in the East because state and local fire agencies don't always track the same information. The data we do have shows that 70% of wildfires occur outside of Western states. But one estimate says local firefighters respond to 900 wildfires each day on average. We also know many local departments aren't prepared for wildfires. These fires are probably smaller than what we see on television. An acre here, an acre there. That small grass fire by the side of the road may not seem like a big deal until it rages out of control. All it takes is an ember carried by an unexpected gust of wind. That's what happened in South Carolina 3 years ago.
It never even crossed my mind that I could potentially lose everything to a fire.
Jody Aldridge's condo burned in a fire. There have been more than 78,000 fires in her state between 1992 and 2013.
If you drove from one street to the next street, you could look down and see flames. You imagine two-story condos. There's four units in each building, and there's nothing but flames and black smoke.
Flames jumped from bush to bush and building to building. They melted the white picket fences that lined the streets.
I mean, usually what we get are smaller brush fires, but other than that, it had never been this huge danger that we had heard of.
Jody left behind a puppy called Puck and pretty much everything else.
Baby pictures, things from high school, some of the things as a woman you hold on to a certain outfit because you remember an event that was special to you, that you wore that to, things like that that I can't ever get back.
After the fire, she trained to become a volunteer firefighter and got a better understanding of just how much the homes and the people who live in them are at risk.
I don't know if I'm more aware of it now, but I do feel like the number of fires have increased each year.
More fires mean more homes are likely to burn. There's no getting around that, says Jim Hubbard. He is the man in charge of wildfires for the Forest Service.
I would say that we will continue to lose buildings and homes. There are just some that aren't going to be saved.
He says saving the lives of residents and firefighters has to be his agency's top priority.
That means there are some places at some times that we won't be able to save the buildings.
Stephen Pine says leaders need to cultivate the political will for change around wildfire policies.
I wonder, well, how did cities quit burning? It's because there were political decisions about building codes, fire insurance standards. There were fundamental issues that were not left to the market, not left to individual or developers' whims. And until we have a political decision on that scale, you're not going to solve the problem. In cities, every fire you put out is a problem solved. In wildlands, most wildlands, every fire you put out is a problem put off.
The U.S. Forest Service owns 100 million acres of overgrown land that need treatment. More than half is at high risk of fire. The agency spends $300 million a year to thin the forest. That covers about 3% of the work it needs to do. Doubling the budget wouldn't come close to finishing the job. What will it cost?
What I can tell you is more money than is likely to be available. We will never have enough money to treat all of the land.
Within budgetary limits, Jim Hubbard of the Forest Service is careful not to make any promises his agency can't keep.
We can't eliminate fire, and we can't restore the forest with just a 10,000-acre treatment. But we might be able to reduce the risk to a community with that treatment.
Forest Service officials decide where to treat using a risk analysis tool. A cold-sounding term, especially when the decisions they make mean that some places will burn. But they don't analyze the risk on every treatment, so there's no way to tell if what they're doing is preventing homes from burning down.
It's certainly being done nationally, regionally, and now we're trying to make sure that the forests and the districts understand how to use the tool. And I wouldn't say we're there everywhere, but it's coming fast.
Jim says the Forest Service has fallen short of its treatment goals the last couple of years because it's still forming alliances with private, military, and state landowners.
We can do a lot of treatments, but if we want to be effective, it requires all of us acknowledging the problem that we will need to manage unplanned wildfire in ways that we haven't in the past.
Thanks to Reveal's Eric Segarra for bringing us that story. Now, nationwide, the new normal is longer fire seasons, bigger wildfires, and it's spreading to new parts of the country. Kansas is seeing its biggest wildfires in recorded history and fighting them with less funding than any other state. That's where we head next on Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX.